Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent, locally owned bookseller. The shop offers the best in literature, current affairs, history, poetry, and of course, books about Baltimore. The Ivy is located at Falls Road at Lake Avenue in Mount Washington. Check it out at theivybookshop.com.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 296 for Thursday, the 7th day of September, 2017. Today, our guest is a veteran journalist and author who used to work for the Sun. Arnold R. Skip Isaacs covered the war in Vietnam in the 1970s. Today, we reach back half a century to separate fact from myth about a conflict that still stirs a lot of passion in American memory. Skip Isaacs' appearance on the show is occasioned by the latest film from Ken Burns, his and Lynn Novick's 10-part, 18-hour documentary on the Vietnam War. The movie premieres on PBS on September 17th. Let's have a listen to the trailer for the film.
I think the Vietnam War drove a stake right into the heart of America. Unfortunately, we've never moved really far away from that. And we never recovered.
There was no way we could avoid telling this story. Wars are so extraordinarily revealing, obviously, of the worst of humanity, but as it turns out, also the best of humanity.
There's been a lot done about this subject. Books, documentaries, feature films, novels. I mean, it's not like no one's ever tried. But it remains this kind of unfinished business in American history.
So it's time now. The decades have passed, and it's important now to go back and try to understand it.
The real heroes are the men that died. To see these kids who had the least to gain, and yet their loyalty to each other, their courage under fire, was just phenomenal. And you would ask yourself, how does America produce young men like this?
We wanted to get to know the people, we wanted to get to know the place, we wanted to spend time there. Trying to figure out how to do what we do in Vietnam was really a challenge.
There's no one American side. And then within Vietnam, there's the winning side, there's the losing side. They were our enemy and our ally. There's just so many different perspectives, we tried to bring them all together.
This is without a doubt the most ambitious project that we have ever undertaken. PBS is the only place it could have been done.
I think the country's ready to have the conversation we've never had about the war, which we really need to have.
This film is not an answer, but a set of questions about what happened.
It will certainly be interesting to see how many Americans choose to watch the Burns-Novick film on PBS. Some 40 million of us watched Burns' film on the Civil War when it first aired in September 1990. But Vietnam? I wonder how many Americans, particularly those who voted last fall to make America great again, will want to visit this long, dark chapter in our history, a war that cost 58,220 Americans their lives, with another 2 million civilian deaths in both North and South Vietnam, and some 1.1 million North Vietnamese and Viet Cong fighters killed. The U.S. military has estimated that up to 250,000 South Vietnamese soldiers died in the war. Those are some of the facts we offer in this warm-up to the Ken Burns-Lynn Novick plunge into Vietnam. Our guest today, Skip Isaacs, is a veteran reporter and editor. He covered the war in Vietnam for The Sun in the 1970s and later wrote two books, Vietnam Shadows, The War, Its Ghosts, and Its Legacy, and Without Honor, Defeat in Vietnam and Cambodia. He taught courses on Vietnam at Towson University. In this episode of Roughly Speaking, a few questions about Vietnam and separating fact from myth. Has the anti-war movement's role in ending the war been overstated over the years? Did the U.S. press corps sway public opinion against continued American involvement? Did final defeat for South Vietnam result from the cutoff of U.S. aid? And, for starters, was the U.S. military really limited in how it could fight the North Vietnamese? The first one reminds me of a quote from Ronald Reagan. The soldiers we sent to Vietnam and the Marines weren't allowed to win. U.S. troops fought with one hand tied behind their backs. This is something we've been told over all these years. I remember Reagan saying that. They weren't allowed to win.
You know, not only on that issue, but much sort of across the board almost, there's been a huge amount of mythologizing about the Vietnam War from both sides in the debate, both the defenders of the policy and those who carried it out, and those who opposed it, demonstrated against it. But each side has created its own myths, and a lot of facts have been lost. And on the, I don't much like calling it the pro-war side, but for shorthand purposes, call it that as opposed to the anti-war side. There's a huge need to find somebody else to blame for the failure, beside the mistakes and the bad strategy and bad execution and bad decisions that led to the war and that were made while it was being carried on. And this is one of them, that, you know, it wasn't our – they're saying it wasn't our fault. You know, the military leadership and the political leadership saying it wasn't our fault, it was somebody else's fault. And this, you know, one hand tied behind their backs is part of that. I think it's a way of saying, well, it wasn't that we were doing anything wrong or that we didn't know how to win. We should have won, and we weren't allowed to do it by malevolent other forces. And, of course, there were limits on military activity. People forget that the initial reason and the main reason was when we got involved in Vietnam was only a dozen years down the line from the Korean War, when MacArthur went across the 38th parallel. And then the next thing he knew, he was looking at, I forget how many, 200,000 Chinese troops staring down his throat, and who almost kicked the Americans right back off the Korean Peninsula. So there was a strong incentive not to provoke the Chinese into intervening in Vietnam. So there were targets, air targets that were close to the Chinese border, were off limits and that kind of thing. So, of course, there were limits. And the idea that our troops fought with one hand tied behind their backs. People who say that should remember some statistics. The use of firepower, for example. The United States dropped about twice as many tons of bombs, aerial bombs, on targets in Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, as all the Allies put together dropped on Germany and Japan in all theaters of World War II. It was a staggering amount of firepower. As far as I know, it's far and away the largest use of air power in the history of the world. On the ground, similarly, there was almost limitless use of artillery and so on.
And this was almost a decade, right? 9 to 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
64 to 73, roughly.
About, yeah, the period of U.S. involvement. And those figures are even more staggering when you compare them with the other side. For most of the period of U.S. involvement, we were shooting off several hundred times more ammunition than the communist side was. And the argument that we didn't use enough power, that, you know, that we restricted our use of power and to the point where we kept ourselves from winning, seems to me almost indefensible when you look at the actual numbers of the power that we did use. And the idea that if we'd used more of it, we would have won. It seems to me much more logical to conclude that the American way of making war could not win that war.
I think a lot of people just couldn't believe it, that you had all this bombing of the North, constant bombing of the North, this big U.S. firepower from the sea, from the ground, from the air, and we still couldn't succeed.
You know, some years after the war, when I was working on my book, I interviewed the next-to-last defense attaché in Saigon, who was a quite remarkable character, a two-star named John Murray. And he was passionate that the reductions in aid had stabbed the Vietnamese in the back and made them lose the war. So he was going on. General Murray was not a guy you could interrupt, so this was all sort of a stream of consciousness on his part. So he was making that argument. And in mid-sentence, he sort of stopped, and he looked up at the ceiling, and then he started reeling off numbers. I don't remember what all of them were, but he would say things like, you know, we had, between the U.S. and the Vietnamese, we had something like 1.5 million troops engaged. They had maybe a fifth of that. Our side had something like, I think it was 5,000 fixed and rotary wing aircraft, and they had, for practical purposes, none. We had, I think it was 12 or 13,000 artillery tubes. They had a much smaller number and much lighter weapons, mortars for the most part. And he went on and he reeled off more numbers that I don't remember anymore. And then he sort of looked up at the ceiling for a minute and said, and you know, with all that stuff, he said, we should have cleaned their clock no matter what mistakes we made. And I don't understand why we didn't. The conclusion that I draw, I don't think Murray did, but the conclusion that I draw was, well, that wasn't the way to win. Anybody who thinks that we didn't win because we didn't use enough force should really remember the disparity in the force that was used.
Let's do something for those who aren't quite sure what the objective was. What would winning have constituted for the United States in the mid-1960s?
You know, I've been listening to this for what feels like 100 years. We didn't have a clear objective. I don't remember ever being in the slightest doubt, and I don't believe that any of the American commanders were in the slightest doubt what the objective was. The objective was to grind down the communist force to the point where it would become like a police problem for that the South Vietnamese could handle by themselves.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, and I think that was perfectly obvious.
Stop them so we can leave the South Vietnamese to control the border and have a country.
Yeah.
Did it become clear to Lyndon Johnson in 1968 that the war could not be won, that even that objective could not be achieved? Is that why he chose not to run for re-election?
I think I read his memoir when it came out 100 years ago, but I don't remember exactly what he says. But it is documented that his new Secretary of Defense, Clark Clifford, the man who replaced Robert McNamara, reached that conclusion who came into office as a hawk, but reached that conclusion very quickly, that not that there was no strategy to win, but that there was no strategy to win at a thinkable cost. You know, if we put like another million troops in there and had another 100,000 casualties, maybe we could have won, but nobody was, you know, was prepared to think that Vietnam was worth that kind of cost. Clark Clifford was one of these guys who was sort of a pillar of the Cold War establishment, one of the architects of the Cold War, and that group, who were known as the Wise Men, former Secretary of State Dean Acheson, a couple of World War II generals, Omar Bradley and Matthew Ridgway, Cyrus Vance, other names that may not be very familiar now, but that were pretty much household names 50 years ago. That group, by and large, reached that conclusion that there was no winning strategy that was feasible and that the alternative was to pull out. And Johnson accepted that, or at least acted on that logic.
Here's another point we need to go over. Mm. The Vietnam draft was a moral disgrace.
Well, that's a judgment, I guess, not a fact.
No, it's not a fact, but it's something that's been said many times. That it was a joke, actually, that the draft was a joke, that anyone could get out of it, and that only the poor served in Vietnam.
Well, that, I think, is exaggerated. It wasn't that simple. But the privileged did much better at getting out of the draft than the less privileged. And the most shameful piece of that story is something called Project 100,000 that hardly anybody has ever heard of. I've written a little bit about it because I reviewed a very, very powerful book on that subject. The manpower pool for Vietnam was plenty big enough, more than big enough, because they were the first generation of the baby, the first years of the baby boom. It was a huge population. I discovered to my surprise that I was born in 1941. I was sort of draftable fairly shortly before the Vietnam draft, but when I was going to get drafted, we didn't think about going to Vietnam at all. A higher percentage of my age group served in the military than the guys who were draft age during Vietnam. So they could have raised standards and still easily met the needs. And instead, they passed this off and may, for all I know, may have sincerely believed as a kind of social welfare program, but they lowered the standards. And McNamara was the principal promoter of this.
This was Project 100,000, yes, to lower the standards.
Right. And he required that the draft boards call up, I think it was 10% of the draftees at the very bottom level of qualification on what was called the Armed Forces Qualifying Test, which is essentially an intelligence test. And another 5% below the minimum. Guys who would have been turned down would not have been drafted by that standard beforehand. Altogether, they drafted about 360,000 men who were at that minimum or below minimum level. And these guys, a lot of them, especially at the lower end, were completely unqualified. These were men who couldn't tie their shoes or tell left from right.
Low scoring on intelligence tests.
Right. There's an amazing book, which is called McNamara's Folly, by a writer named Hamilton Gregory. He himself was a Vietnam veteran. He had volunteered. He wasn't drafted. He encountered some of these guys, and he was so troubled and so outraged that for 40 years after the war, he continued to collect material and documents and records and hunt down people and so on. And he wrote this book, which came out, I think, about a year or two ago. And it is ironclad. It may be the best documented work of this kind that I've ever seen.
Skip, was it thought that if you lowered the standards and increased the numbers, there'd be fewer deferments, fewer college boys, basically?
Well, that is certainly the logical assumption, that tightening up on middle class and upper middle class young men would have further weakened political support for the war, and that Johnson and McNamara were very reluctant to do that. Again, I'm not a mind reader. I don't know what was in their minds. But that was certainly the effect, that young men from privileged backgrounds could avoid service. You know, ask Bill Clinton, ask Donald Trump, ask Rush Limbaugh.
Dick Cheney.
And Richard Cheney. Yeah, I mean, you have a whole, really, the class that they represent, they didn't get off completely scot-free, but the level of sacrifice that class paid compared to the level that less privileged and less politically potent sectors of the society paid, to me, it adds up to a moral disgrace, yes.
19 Harvard College alumni died in Vietnam. Dundalk High School, outside of Baltimore here, attended largely by steelworkers' kids, with a male student body a sixth of Harvard's, lost 23 in Vietnam.
And of those 19, the only one who was drafted and who was not a commissioned officer, who was enlisted man in the sense of being lower rank, you know, not commissioned, and only one Harvard man died as a draftee. There was only almost all the others were commissioned officers. I suspect in most cases they were ROTC. They got commissioned because they had gone through ROTC.
And the draft ended in 1973. We haven't had a draft since then.
No, that's right.
There were college deferments. College boys got out of going to Vietnam. But college boys and girls, men and women, took part in protests. So this is the next thing I want to ask you about. Peace marches. Some people believe that there should be a monument put up to the protesters of the Vietnam War at some point to recognize their role in ending that war.
Of course they had a role. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that the anti-war movement had no political effect. Of course it did. But the sort of the common mythology that we got into this war and then protests mounted and eventually the protesters were strong enough and vocal enough that they kind of compelled the government to change course.
And it's why LBJ didn't run for re-election.
Right.
Right.
And this is ignoring a lot of other factors. I already spoke a few minutes ago about the wise men, about Clark Clifford and Dean Acheson and people like that. Nobody who knows anything about those men would think that they changed their minds because of a lot of long-haired kids waving signs on college campuses around the country. I think it also has to be said that the change in opinion and public support was certainly not exclusively the result of the peace movement and the demonstrations. I don't know how you would weigh the different factors. I don't think there's any way to scientifically do that. But I believe that a more significant factor was that after 3-4 years, people couldn't see any sign that we were getting anywhere. They were watching kids come home in body bags, and they couldn't see that it was accomplishing anything.
And they were, in fact, watching. They were actually watching the evening news.
Well, yeah,
sure. This war was not televised, but a lot of it was seen on TV.
Those images were probably less gruesome than the popular fiction has made them in retrospect. But yes, of course, it got into the living rooms, as people say. And I think more and more and more people, including people who were very negative about the peace demonstrators. They didn't like the long hair. They didn't like the funny cigarettes. They didn't like the bad language. I mean, you know. But at the same time, the war began to seem to them as throwing good lives and good money after bad. And they turned against it, sort of independently of the peace movement.
In 1970, there was a large demonstration at Kent State University in Ohio that resulted in the deaths of, I think, 4 students.
That's
who were
right.
Fired upon by the National Guardsmen.
4 people. I think.
I don't know if they were all students.
One or two of them were not students.
Okay.
But, yeah.
And I had a memory I wanted to share with you about that when I saw this on your list, that the anti-war movement didn't change public opinion all by itself. I remember going to Mass the following Sunday after Kent State. I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And the priest was railing against the demonstrators, basically blaming the victims for throwing rocks or inciting a riot or just being out there demonstrating against the war. I remember getting pretty upset about what he was saying. He went out of his way to say this during his homily during Catholic Mass. I have that memory of it. So, a lot of people didn't appreciate the demonstrators. And I don't know about you, Skip, but I remember having conversations with World War II veterans, including my uncles, sitting around a kitchen table on a Sunday at, you know, a family get-together, erupting into a violent argument about the Vietnam War. Two very different generations, two very different views about what should be happening.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm sure that happened a lot. You know, Vietnam wasn't the only issue. It was kind of the visible issue. But underneath that was this whole sort of big cultural change, too, that had nothing to, you know, not related to the war, but a sort of an assault on conventional values and ways of behaving and conduct and so on and so forth. And you know what? I mean, I don't know what your priest in
Massachusetts that was,
would have said, but it's absolutely conceivable that after giving his homily and disparaging the demonstrators, that if you'd gone up to him afterward and said, well, Father, what should we do in Vietnam? It is absolutely conceivable that he said, we should get out. I don't know that he would have or not, you know, but I mean, there were plenty of people who were true believers who still thought we should fight to win. But by 1970, an awful lot of people who felt exactly the way your priest felt about the demonstrators also had decided that the war was
futile.
Useless.
Yeah.
Not immoral, not wrong.
Just futile.
But not getting anywhere. Yeah.
By then, Richard Nixon was president.
Yeah.
Richard Nixon had a plan to end the war. And when you reflect on the time here, he was elected in 68, took office in 69. 69 goes by, 70 goes by, more Americans are dying. They're still dying. 71, 72, 70. That's a lot of years to have a plan to end the war and for the war to continue. So even though maybe Americans were becoming impatient and understanding that we were getting nowhere, it still went on. The fall of Saigon was 5 years down the road from Kent State.
Well, I think Nixon had an exaggerated idea that he could lean on the Soviet Union and the communist regime in China, and that they could put enough pressure on the North Vietnamese to make them stop the war. I think most historians, even then, could have told Nixon it wasn't going to work that way. The Vietnamese decisions were very independent. Nobody remembers this anymore, but Ho Chi Minh owed nothing to the Soviets and the Chinese, who gave him very belatedly no help at all in the first several years of his war for independence from France, and then after that, quite grudgingly. So I think Nixon had this kind of big power mentality that, you know, that it was all a big chess game and that the little guys would do what the big guys told them to do. And I think that was a delusion, but I think that's what my guess is that's what he meant by this plan.
Mm-hmm. Because he did go to China. He opened the door to China in 72,
72,
right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the press for a minute, the press in the Vietnam War. We were talking about the television news, the networks covering Vietnam. I remember people saying, well, Walter Cronkite swayed public opinion. There was some report that Cronkite did. I don't know what year it was. But when Americans saw that Walter Cronkite seemed to believe there was no way to win the war, that really turned public opinion. But more generally, let's talk about the role of the press. Journalists lost the war because they celebrated the other side and they vilified the American effort.
Well, this is part of what I was saying before, that people who were looking around for somebody else to blame beside bad policy and bad execution. And journalists are one of them, and there is this kind of folklore, and we're living through another period of highly embroidered attacks on the press as being disloyal and dishonest. And
that
so
took
on.
Place during Vietnam, too.
Yeah. I mean, not to the extent that we're seeing it now, and I don't think it became as public an issue or an issue for the public and to the same degree that it does now. Although, actually, the argument about the press, disloyal press being responsible in Vietnam was, a lot of it was after the fact. There was a certain amount of friction during the war, but a lot of it, more of it, a lot of the exaggerations came afterward.
About the press's role, the press celebrating the North Vietnamese. Right.
And painting American soldiers as war criminals.
Right.
And both of those, the people who make these charges give, generally speaking, they give no examples. And for practical purposes, there aren't any examples because it didn't happen that way. The war criminals business. American journalists in Vietnam were, if they did anything, they underreported civilian casualties and all these issues about what happened to the civilian population. They did not go out of their way to report atrocities. And in fact, they reported very few atrocities. The biggest atrocity story of the war, and the one that became a big news event during the war, was the My Lai massacre. And that was not reported by any, that story wasn't broken by any American reporter in Vietnam. It was broken by, months after it happened, by Cy Hirsch, who at that time...
Was at the New York Times, right?
No,
Was that before he was at the Times?
Before he was at the Times.
Hmm.
And he broke it. And that's right, the major media were very gingerly about that story. And it broke in a little sort of countercultural news agency called Dispatch News.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Hmm. And it broke because when the court-martial of Lieutenant Calley, the commander of the platoon that committed the killings, went on trial down in Fort Benning, Georgia, and that caught Cy Hirsch's eye, and he went down and investigated and found this out. The actual massacre was in March of 1968. And a few weeks later, Radio Hanoi and the communist media reported actually a pretty accurate account of what happened. An American news media monitored the communist broadcasts and all that kind of thing.
Did the press assume it was propaganda?
Yes, of course they did. And they got the division wrong. The communist broadcast identified a different unit. So the American command could say, no, that unit was not operating anywhere in that area. And no one, there must have been hundreds of American correspondents in Vietnam at that time. That was one of the high points of coverage. And none of them went to check it out. And then it didn't, nobody reported it until, I think it was almost a year later or sometime the following year when Cy Hirsch broke the story. And the idea that the press was out there sort of foaming at the mouth and looking around for ways to show American soldiers as war criminals is absolute baloney. It didn't happen.
And what about celebrating the other side?
Well, that's another one. I mean, not only did they not celebrate the other side. I was there at the end. My own experience covering Vietnam. So I can't speak for the press corps 3-4 years before I got there, but I can certainly, I think I have a pretty strong, good sense of attitudes among the correspondents during my time. And I was there for, on and off, but mostly on for 3 years. And a lot of the same people were still there. When the communists won, there was no celebration. Preponderant opinion was deep sadness. A lot of us, including me, thought that the war had been a big mistake by the United States, but that didn't mean we were rooting for the other side. And I think that's a complete misrepresentation at any point, say that the reporting was slanted to portray the communists in a favorable light. And the fact is, they did almost no reporting on the communist side or on our side. For a long period of time, not that reporters didn't cover some of this stuff, but what reached the public and what shaped opinion and so on, was almost exclusively reporting on U.S. troops in combat.
Mm-hmm.
The Vietnamese side of the story, Vietnamese politics, Vietnamese society, Vietnamese history, was...
Very little of that.
Almost invisible. Yeah.
No. In fact, I can attest, I'll throw in another personal memory here, of the daily newspaper in the town where I grew up, Brockton, Massachusetts, the Brockton Daily Enterprise... Mm-hmm. And every day, the off-lead, meaning the left side of the front page, American forces, U.S. forces kill 900 Reds, mm-hmm. or some headline like that. It gave a body count. This was for years and years and years. The Vietnam story occupied that space on the front page. That's all we saw, really. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we understood what this was all about, except we were fighting communists, Well, and there were these body counts.
When you're sort of reporting something day to day, you don't, you may not have quite the same perspective that you do looking back on it. But in the end, I think that the media, the real criticism of American media coverage of Vietnam is not that it was biased against U.S. policy or against U.S. troops, but that it didn't succeed in explaining the war. This war could not be understood by just reporting on the battles. This war was a piece of Vietnamese history that predated the American intervention, and Vietnamese society and Vietnam's past and the circumstances. And without those, the battles were meaningless.
And what happened at the end there? We just got on the helicopters and got out?
Well, the American piece of that story begins with the negotiations.
Paris peace talks.
And there was a peace agreement that was reached in January of 1973. This is more than 2 years before the end. And that is when the last American troops left. Now, they'd been withdrawing Nixon had been withdrawing American troops over the previous, most of his first term. And so the U.S. force that was still there at the time of the agreement was much, much reduced from what it had been at the peak. And after that agreement, the proclamation and the hope was that the South Vietnamese could defend themselves. I wrote a 500-page book on this story.
I know you did.
So it's a little hard to boil it down.
I think people should try to understand what happened at the end there, those last 2 years.
Well, the short version, I guess, would be that the Americans got what they wanted out of the peace agreement, which is that they got their troops out and they got the POWs back. We had about 600 prisoners of war. It's a complete myth that there were other prisoners who weren't returned. That is obvious. That's a falsehood, too. And the North Vietnamese got... That's what the North Vietnamese wanted. Both the North Vietnamese and the Americans wanted an end to direct American military involvement. Those were the only provisions of the peace agreement that were actually carried out. The rest of the agreement was that the Vietnamese sides were supposed to observe a ceasefire in place. Everybody's supposed to stop where they were on the morning of January 28, 1973. And that there would then be a negotiating process for, on the one hand, to sort of administer and make the ceasefire into a more sort of permanent armistice of some kind, and B, to lead toward new elections or some kind of political process that would decide South Vietnam's political future.
And the North would recognize the sovereignty of the South?
Oh, no. No. Well, that was one of the fatal flaws in the agreement was that was non-negotiable for either side, that the North Vietnamese were never going to recognize the legitimacy of South Vietnam, and the South Vietnamese were never going to recognize that there were anybody but foreign aggressors on the other side.
Okay, so was it sort of like a Korean War ceasefire, similar to that?
Well, the reason that it wasn't similar was that there was no clear front line.
Yeah.
In Korea, you had a traditional battlefield situation, so when you blew the whistle, everybody kind of knew who belonged where. And, you were on this side of the line, you were on Allied South Korean territory, and this side of the line, you were on the North Korean and Chinese side. But in Vietnam, people called it the leopard spots, it was this completely diffuse geographically. And there was no agreement on who belonged where. In a few places where the lines were clear, and there were some, for maybe a couple of months, the fighting died down. But in most of the country, where the front was not clear, everybody continued to fight for what they thought they were entitled to in the ceasefire in place. And instead of reducing the fighting, the level of fighting went up sharply. The ceasefire never took hold, and the Americans were sort of left in the position of, what they had officially declared a support for South Vietnamese regime in a ceasefire situation turned out to be supporting an all-out war, not fought with American troops. The Americans really lost interest by that time. When American boys weren't being killed and wounded, the American public had really had enough.
And the next time we looked up at our TV screens, Saigon was falling. People were on the roofs of buildings.
Exactly.
Because I remember those 2 years where we just sort of like...
Oh, yeah. Nobody
Vietnam,
paid
no one paid any attention anymore. Right.
But during those 2 years, Congress significantly reduced. They did not cut off aid. You'll hear a lot of people say, we cut them off and that's why they lost. Well, there was never any cutoff. But there were significant reductions. There were shortages on the battlefield, although they were still much more heavily armed and equipped than the other side was. So people blame the aid reduction. It was all Congress's fault. If they hadn't cut the aid, the South Vietnamese wouldn't have lost. But that overlooks a couple of other significant facts. The main one, in my opinion, South Vietnamese war aim, after all the Americans were gone, remained exactly the same as their war aim when they had a 500,000 American troops and 2,000-3,000 American bombers flying around dropping bombs on, you know, blowing up palm trees and water buffalo and the occasional enemy soldier, and to defend every square yard of territory that they could reach and to clear the communists out of wherever they could do it. That was something we hadn't been able to do it with all that American power. It was clearly unrealistic for the South Vietnamese to do it without American power. But they never changed that strategy, and they wasted huge amounts of supplies and weapons and lost a lot of troops in those operations that if they had figured out what they could realistically try to defend, they would have kept. There were 3 years there of unprecedented high casualties. South Vietnamese morale was really down. Desertions from the army skyrocketed. Corruption skyrocketed because you had an economic crisis at the same time. It was a badly weakened South Vietnam that went into the final crisis, and a lot of that weakening was self-inflicted. A lot of it did not have to happen. The cuts, it's like the peace movement and the change of American policy. The cuts were part of that story, but certainly not the whole story.
Ken Burns, of course, he's the filmmaker, and he wants people to tune in, so he needs to make it sound relevant to today. I've heard him make statements in the press about how Vietnam still haunts us, how there are unresolved questions about what happened there, and Vietnam still informs our attitudes. Do you think that's true? Do you think we're still sort of licking our wounds from Vietnam, that it still forms attitudes about our role in the world?
Well, you know, I mean, I think for the generation that went through it, feelings are still pretty strong. I mean, that mine are, from what I witnessed, and I'm in touch with plenty of people who, in one way or another, went through that experience in the military or other journalists whom I knew. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know lots of people who were involved in it. So I think in my generation, it's a little hard for me to project what somebody 30 years old now, you know, who was born 10 years after that war ended, how strong. I mean, I assume that a lot of them have given it no thought whatsoever. Now, maybe some of them will watch the show and who knows what they'll take away from it. I would be astonished if it were as emotional an issue for that generation as it would be for those of us who remember it. I think on the policy level, we're now even a longer period of years into frustrating, difficult, and inconclusive wars. The casualty list is not nearly as long. I think we've lost, 5,000-6,000 Americans
in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah. Versus 58,000.
Yeah, so much. We haven't had the 101st Airborne or the 1st Infantry Division out there slogging around, getting into firefights. Well, I suppose we have to some extent, but not on the same scale. But a lot of the dilemmas, the circumstances. I don't want to make sort of facile comparisons. It's a different world. It's a different military. It's a different history. But I think some of the issues are very resonant. And what do you do? You know, how do you square the realities of those wars with an American mythology of you know, the exceptional number one, all powerful nation, or in what do we call it, the indispensable nation, and all this kind of stuff? That the landscape doesn't look that way. You know,
right. I mean,
the reality doesn't really live up to that myth.
Could you narrow it down to this? That our attitude toward anything that looks like a civil war keeps us from military intervention.
There was the so-called Vietnam Syndrome. That was a term usually used critically, that the experience of Vietnam had paralyzed us and that we were not willing to, you know, to use our military force where we should have and where we could have been successful. Well, I mean, that came to an end after September 11th, 2001. And since that time, you know, we invaded Iraq, we invaded Afghanistan.
And there was the first Persian Gulf War, 91.
Well, that's true.
Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that was, there's a lot of twists and turns along that road. But I guess to me, and this is a judgment that I'm sure lots of people would disagree with, but I think that one similarity is that we haven't figured out how to win this kind of war against an ideologically driven adversary and with an ally who has critical political and social weaknesses. The lesson I came home from Vietnam was, you know, Clausewitz, I guess, was supposed to say, and they teach you at the military academy, know your enemy. Somebody didn't teach the Americans, know your friend. And if I had to boil down the lesson of Vietnam for me, that it would be that. We didn't know our friend. We convinced ourselves, the leadership, I mean, convinced themselves that South Vietnam had qualities and resilience that it didn't have. And I think you can find a lot of parallels to that in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I haven't seen much sign that they figured out the solution.
One last thing in terms of the emotional connection to this, I've always felt all the way through was that you don't blame the soldiers for what the generals and the presidents asked them to do. And I've always felt a lot of sympathy for Vietnam veterans.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think the victimization of the Vietnam veterans is also something that's gotten kind of fictionalized over the years.
That might have gone a bit too far. And the Vietnam veterans will tell you that they didn't like these portrayals, especially in popular culture, in the media, movies, for instance.
Well, that's true. That's true. But I also think that what they remember is a hostile greeting when they came home.
Right.
I tend to think that a lot, there was some, but I tend to think that an awful lot of it was not hostile, but kind of uncomprehending. And they themselves didn't know. They didn't speak about it because they didn't know what to say, because their experience did not match up with what we learn from our culture is the experience of Americans going to war. And, I mean, if you forgive a bit of a digression, I remember I was at one of, you know, I conservatively estimate 11,000 panel discussions on the press in Vietnam, or however many we've had in the last 30 years. And some guy came up to me, and, you know, three or four of us former correspondents were there trying to explain what I was saying to you before. I guess he'd asked a question saying that he thought the coverage was hostile to American troops. And he came up with his evidence, and it was a Newsweek or Time magazine, and it was a photograph. I didn't make notes, so I can't tell you exactly. I think it was from the siege of Con Tien. And the photograph was a close-up of a young Marine, and he's kind of hunched next to a sandbag, waiting for that next round to come in. And you could see, you know, the sort of the tension, and it was, you know, I thought it was a great photograph. And I couldn't imagine why anybody would think this was hostile or unsympathetic. But as the guy kept talking, it dawned on me, he didn't want to see a picture. He was a Marine himself. He had been a Marine veteran. And he didn't want to see a guy cowering. From shell fire. He wanted to see Marines raising the flag over Mount Suribachi.
Yeah.
The Iwo Jima picture, one that's on the Marine Corps Memorial. And I thought to myself,
Super icon that looms
absolutely
over generations.
And I think it still does.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that was somewhere in his sort of mental images when he joined the Marine Corps. And there wouldn't have been any point in saying to him, but what I was thinking was, well, you know, it wasn't the journalist's fault that they didn't take a picture of a scene that didn't happen in Vietnam. There was no Suribachi. No Iwo Jima victory in Vietnam. And I think a lot of this feeling that they were treated hostily, a lot of it is actually unrecognized self-doubt. A lot of it is, this was precisely, I don't know what percentage of Vietnam veterans had fathers who were in World War II, but it must have been a very high percentage.
I would be with you in guessing that.
And they would have been comparing their war with their father's war.
It was a constant.
And their homecoming, one at a time,
yeah,
when their tour was up, and they just sort of come back into, you know, Brockton, Mass, or Dundalk, Maryland,
Baltimore,
or someplace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And people would say, hey, where you been? You know? Compared to the parade, the ships coming back victorious and parades and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of their own doubt, and not doubt and confusion, maybe confusion more than doubt, compared to their image of the way they should have come home, was inside their heads than was actually what they experienced. And there's this, you know, spitting story, which is very little verification for any of that.
That citizens actually spit on returning
GIs. Guys, I mean, I once talked to a guy who said, you know, he said, I've been telling people for 20 years that I got spit on at the airport. He said, but actually, I'm not sure whether it really happened or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a huge amount of, I think that became a symbol, it became a metaphor, and it reflected the feelings that they were having.
Personally, I never felt this way about...
Well, the peace movement didn't.
Yeah, the peace movement didn't feel this way about the soldiers.
I covered the peace movement for a long time before I went. I tell people I was an anti-war correspondent before I became a war correspondent. And no, that generally speaking, they wanted to get the soldiers on their side.
They wanted to save lives.
Well, they had an exaggerated idea of anti-war feeling in the military, which there was quite a bit. And, you know, by the soldiers came out of the population, they reflected the population, and his opinion changed. A lot of soldiers that went, especially later on.
John Kerry,
right.
Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Exactly. And most of the ones that I remember, again, this is all sort of episodic, it's not scientific, but it's completely inconsistent with my memory of the attitudes and the actions of the peace demonstrators that I saw, that they would go out to the airport and spit on some guy in uniform getting off an airplane. You can't, obviously, no way to say it never happened, but it was certainly not typical, or at least I think. I'm pretty certain it was not typical and nowhere near as universal as the popular mythology has made it.
Well, I'm eager to see the Ken Burns film because I admire the filmmaker, but also because I want to go over this again. Right. And see what he learned. And he says he learned a lot. He says he actually, in one interview, that he was humiliated by the things he didn't know about the Vietnam War.
Well, we'll see. So.
Arnold R. Skip Isaacs covered the Vietnam War in the 1970s for the Baltimore Sun. He's the author of two books, Vietnam Shadows and Without Honor. He taught courses on Vietnam at Towson University. The new Ken Burns Lynn Novick film, The Vietnam War, premieres September 17th on PBS. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Dan Rodrigues here at the Baltimore Sun. We'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodrigues is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.